He left a successful career on Wall Street so he could set the record straight on cable news. He did such a great job that even President Trump noticed and asked for his help. Now, he's become a champion for American nationalism and a proud spokesman for the deplorables. He's Steve Cortez, and this is the Steve Cortez Show on AM 560, The Answer.
Welcome to Hour 2 of the Steve Cortez Show. Charles Love sitting in. And we spent the last hour talking about crime and policing and what we can do about those problems. And hopefully you got some ideas, not as many, but we may have even more suggestions and ideas on this topic because this is kind of my wheelhouse. And I got another pro online, a couple here. But we want to talk about education this hour. And we know with COVID, all over the news, as I look up at Fox News now, it says that there's a growing debate over reopening schools. And we want to talk about what we should do, what we shouldn't do, and if we do reopen, how we do it. And on the live line with me now, I have Paul Vallis, who is the former superintendent of Bridgeport Public Schools and CEOs of both Philadelphia and Chicago Public Schools and a former candidate for mayor. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Charles.
Well, it's great to have you. And I just want to get right to that. I know I've seen your opinion, but why don't you tell the people what your opinion is about reopening the schools in the fall?
Well, look, let me point out that serious damage is done when kids are out of school for extended periods of time. In fact, the poorer the children, the greater the loss of knowledge. There are studies that have shown that just summer alone, children will lose 20% of the knowledge that was accumulated during the previous year. But we've had kids who have been out of school for 4 months, not counting the 14 or 15 strike days. So clearly, damage is being done. Mental atrophy sits in. And, you know, so many poor children are dependent on the schools for so many other things, the social, emotional support, nutrition, et cetera. And although the district has done its best to provide, obviously, food services and things like that. But also working families are punished, too, because it's not, you know, working families can't afford to have someone sit with their children or bring a sitter in. A lot of times the kids are left home alone. Sometimes the parent can't go to work because the child's at home. So clearly, it's really important that schools reopen and that schools reopen in a timely manner this coming fall.
Yeah, and I think that's important. I think that there's obviously legitimate concerns with COVID and others and what they should do and what the problems are. There's no doubt about that, and I have no issues with people, you know, contemplating that and figuring out what they do. My concern is I hear so many loud voices about what the concerns are about being in a classroom during the time of COVID with the kids, but very little about the things you mentioned, but then all the other problems you have with not going, because there are also concerns and problems with not going back to school, right? The things you mentioned, but also,
exactly.
You know, the schools, the kids are several ages, so let's throw high school out for a minute, but let's say kindergarten through third grade, you know, so a lot of what they learn is, you know, how to learn to share, how to deal with others, and that things of that nature. And people try to compare the homeschooling mix, but homeschooling is different because they're built for that. So those parents have curriculums at home where the average parent won't, and they still find ways to incorporate the social aspect to the learning, right? But you're not going to do that when you're social distancing and staying at home. So you got kids who are 5, 6, 7, and 8 that never see another kid for years. That's not normal. I mean, we won't know what the psychological effects to that is for, you know, decades.
Well, let me tell you, well, you know, first of all, kudos for you to be for being so knowledgeable. I thought I was supposed to be the expert. I think I think you're the expert on this. But let me just say, it's really common sense. You have to understand, you know, the pandemic, while it's impacted all of us, and believe me, affluent families are even struggle to homeschool their kids. They're now beginning to appreciate how difficult the teacher's job really is. but there, it clearly impacts poorer families, working families, more. And you know, are the kids actually safer in the community where they're really not being supervised, where they may not, you know, the more affluent you are, the easier it is to learn remotely, to work remotely, to be quarantined. But that's not the same in poor communities. So, you know, and I'm not saying that you reopen schools without a comprehensive, rigorous public safety plan in place.
We're going to get to what you want to do, because you sent me a list about how to do that. But I want to know, what are they saying now that they're thinking about is the way? What are the city's idea of how to open, if possible? What have you heard from them?
I truly believe that the mayor wants to open schools, to get schools reopened. I think she realizes that they really can't restore the economy, reopen the economy without reopening schools. And as I said, working families, the poor, they are impacted the most. How are they going to go to work? You know, these jobs, these low-paying jobs, you know, they're barely surviving with the salaries they have, let alone the additional money that's going to be needed to be spent on daycare and things like that. So, there's a lot of reasons. And look, you know, the bottom line though is, I am sure that the city is particularly now that the state guidelines have come out, and the state put out a 60 pages of guidelines, and you know, it's enough to make your eyes bleed, so to speak. But the bottom line is, the guidelines focus on core areas that need to be addressed if you're going to have the proper public safety plan. And it's real simple. I mean, these are the things that reduce the infection, the transmission of infection. These are the things that improve health and safety. The first thing is, you have to screen. And that means you've got to get the parents screening at home, and you've got to screen everybody who comes in that school. And let me tell you, they have the technology in place now where you can have these you can have these facial recognition devices. They're like scanners, some even like kiosks. And what they do is they actually can do in a second. You've got the temperature checked, elevated. And it's not foolproof. You know, I mean, there may be individuals who are asymptomatic, who don't have high temperatures. But, you know, it's a combination of things you do to reduce the risk. So the bottom line is, they've got to instruct parents on how to do basic screening at home so they're not sent to school, but that anyone who enters that school needs to be screened. That's number one. Number two, anyone who enters that school needs to be masked. They're going to have to mask. It's as simple as that. They're going to have to get comfortable. They're going to have to work with masks. And, you know, masks are not expensive. You can both purchase masks for like $5 a mask. You can purchase masks that are reusable. So the bottom line is, you screen again. Someone leaves the building, come back, you screen again. You mask. People need to be masked. And obviously you need the other equipment if you're doing other forms of testing or monitoring. But the bottom line is, everybody has to be masked. The third thing is, you have to socially distance. And what the state has basically said is, look, you've got to adhere to the 6-foot rule where you're, however you set things up, the desks, the tables, the lunchroom, people have to be 6 feet apart. And you can't be gathering in a single location of more than 50 people. Now, let me tell you, for some schools, that's not going to be difficult to do. For other schools, that may be more difficult, depending on whether or not they're overcrowded and things like that. But
well, let me interrupt you and ask you this, though. What is your question? What is your thoughts on the, I don't know if Chicago's doing it, but I hear some cities are talking about staggering people or staggering days, so like 2 days, three days a week.
Yeah, you know, look, you know, I think you're going to have to be flexible. I think it's going to be easier to do the staggering for the older kids than the younger kids. For example, I mean, if I were running the district, you know, I would look at jettisoning a lot of these irrelevant electives, and I would allow the high school kids to get into work-study programs, internships, apprenticeships. You know, you get them off campus, you get them in safe environments. You know, I mean, there's no reason why every city agency can't have a work-study program for kids. Whether it's you want to improve the relationship between the police and fire in the community, let them have work-study internships, the streets and sanitation, transportation, et cetera. I mean, at the end of the day, those things can be very, very, very beneficial. But the point that I want to make is for younger kids, that's a little more difficult. For the older kids, it's easier. But they have partitions. If you look at what they've done in Korea, for example, or Japan or in Singapore, they have these plastic partitions. They cost like $15 a partition, $15 to $20. And you can, in effect, they're plexiglass. I mean, you can, in effect.
I think
know,
I want to. I want to end on that because I think it's important. I think that a lot of these points that you sent me are really good. The mask thing is questionable only because, not that I'm saying they shouldn't mask up. What I'm saying is I don't see the feasibility. I think the partitioning is better and the masks need to be mandatory and be there for certain situations where you can't socially distance. But I think the bigger focus should be on social distance because my concern is kids, you know, kindergarten, right, 5 through 8 are not going to keep them on because they don't understand the importance. They're not going to be able to hear the teacher and that kind of thing. I think you partition the front, space people out, put partitions where you can. And when the kids come together, exactly, to do certain things, then they mask. Because what I'm hearing, in, at least here in New York, is mask all the time, all day. Don't take it off. That's asinine. It's not going to happen.
Particularly the younger kids. You know the way young kids are.
Exactly. So saying that is just silly, is what I think. But everything else, I think you're spot on. I think it's important. I hope people listen to you and take your knowledge and your former position to heart and kind of find a nuanced and important way. I think you need to focus on the younger kids because they're going to need it more than everybody else, but so will the older kids. And I truly appreciate your time, Paul Vallis. Thank you for joining me.
It's my pleasure. Happy. You know, I have posted this on my LinkedIn. So if anybody wants to look at what I've put out on reopening schools, as well as how to create a remote learning platform so you can teach children online or blended learning, I've posted my information on my LinkedIn. So if you just look at Paul Vallis on LinkedIn, you can. All this stuff is online.
All right. Thanks. Have a great evening.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that was good. That's good information. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. But the bigger thing I want to talk about, as difficult as that is, and that's splattered all over the news, my biggest concern is once they iron out what they're going to do and when they're going to go back to school and how they're going to go back to school, what scares me the most is what they're going to be teaching in the schools. And coming up, we're going to talk about that, what the problems are, what me and my group at Seeking Educational Excellence are trying to do to push back and to hold off some of the madness that's going on. And we're going to talk to somebody who knows about the history and how to teach people the proper way shortly. So stick with us on the Steve Cortez Show on AM 560, The Answer. Welcome back to the Steve Cortez Show. Charles Love sitting in. And we're talking education. So Paul Vallis just told us that the kids need to go to school. And now I want to talk about what they'll be learning. There's a lot of scary things on the horizon here. You hear, even before COVID, there was a big push for the 1619 Project. If you all don't know it, it is a highly skewed, partially fictitious, you know, negative, dark view of American history. And they want to use that to explain why America is flawed and their very unique and extreme way to fix it. And five major school districts, including Chicago, had already signed on to use it. Chicago claims it's optional, but they signed on to use it as curricula, as part of the learning tools for the schools. But now, for some reason, after the George Floyd killing, which was supposed to be about police brutality, we are now being told that Black Lives Matter's beliefs and their agenda needs to be taught in school. We're hearing things from educators and writers on the left saying that we can't go back to school and we can't go back to the old way of learning. And this is going to be important to be woven into the fabric of education. So we need to think about what that's going to look like. You know, again, I say my biggest push is for logic and context. And joining me to help me with that is Larry Swigart. He's a former history professor, a New York Times best-selling author. He literally wrote the book on American history. And I want him to join us to kind of give us an idea of what should be taught, what is being taught, and what the dangers of this new progressive approach to history is. Larry, thanks for joining me on the Steve Cortez Show.
Hey, Charles. Good to be here.
Well, I know for sure you know about that 1619 project. And I think I want to start there because some people may not understand it and talk about, you know, what it is and what they may have gotten wrong. I thought it was funny because when bringing it up, I was looking at just kind of Googling what they say about it. And you'll love this. It says, the New York Times, this is Wikipedia, the New York Times has said that the contributions were deeply researched and arguments verified by a team of fact checkers in consultation with historians. What do you think about that statement?
Well, there were something like a dozen historians, big names, mainstream historians, who came out and took apart the whole 1619 project, just absolutely destroyed it. But their approach, I think, is wrong. It may be necessary to fight and quibble with the specifics, but the very foundations and basis of this are so far off that every American ought to pitch it in Boston Harbor along with all the teeth. What's important here, Charles, is that America is an exceptional nation. We are among all the nations of the earth in all of human history founded in a different way, and that is indisputable. Our founding was not at Jamestown. It was not in the Virginia colony, although that was the first colony. American exceptionalism was established in Plymouth. And Mike Allen and I, in A Patriot's History of the United States, established the four pillars of American exceptionalism, and those are a Christian, mostly Protestant, religious tradition, common law, private property with written titles and deeds, and a free market economy. No other nation in the history of the world has started with those four things, not even England.
Right. I think that's powerful and extremely important. And, you know, I always talk about context, right? And I think that that gets lost on people, especially since, you know, obviously a lot of what they write about in the 1619, and especially this new BLM movement, is written through the lens of black people, Africans, and slavery. So obviously that was a dark spot on our history, and that needs to be taught, and I have no problem with that. Where they go wrong in many of these progressive circles are that the things that they say aren't, you know, colored completely. You don't go full circle. So you kind of just pick something negative, put it out there, and run away. And I think that we're going to get a heavy dose of this in school. And I don't think the average person is prepared to combat it, which is what my problem is. Go ahead.
Charles, that's why I wanted to give your listeners. It's very important, and I'll say this again, it's critical that you understand that America is an exceptional nation because of our founding, which was like no other nation in human history, and it involved Christian, mostly Protestant religious tradition. That's important, not for theology, but because the early pilgrims and Protestants were congregational, and their church structure was bottom up, not top down like every other church structure in the world. And the second one, common law, same thing, comes over from the German tribes. It was the idea that God puts the law in the hearts of the people, and the people elect or select rulers to carry out that law. So right there you have two things that are bottom up that are unseen in all of human history. And you'll notice the one thing that wasn't involved in any of that exceptionalism, slavery.
Slavery.
Slavery,
yes.
Isn't mentioned. It wasn't a part of it. They didn't have slaves in Massachusetts until many, many years later when other people brought them in. It was not a part of American exceptionalism. And this is why people ought to pitch the 1619 Project into the fire, is because it assumes that Jamestown and the 1619 arrival of slaves in Virginia taints American exceptionalism. No, it does not. American exceptionalism was established with no context to slavery whatsoever.
That's absolutely true. And there's ways to prove this. There are writings there. People don't want to read them. And this is where we get back to school. If no one's teaching this stuff, very few people are going to have the energy or the interest to go and find it out. So what we have is a large percentage of the population who only know certain bits of, and even if the what they know is true, it's skewed somehow, and it leaves them, you know, kind of in this weird place, and it creates this negative sentiment about America. So once you have this hatred, you know, it's gonna color everything you think and everything you do.
Right. Well, see, it was no slow process. It took almost maybe over 100 years. But in the late 1800s, a group of German historians began to infiltrate American education with ideas called value-free history. That is, there are these things called facts and there are things called values, and the twain shall never meet. And and therefore, you know, you're missing in that the very essential position that the key truth that you cannot select this fact over that fact and not make a value decision, a choice that this fact is better or more useful or more correct than that fact in this context. And so in doing that, they introduced a type of relativism. Now, Charles, by about the mid-1900s, or about the 1960s, 70s...
Well, hold on right there, because we're up against a hard break, and since you're going to stay over with me for the next segment, we'll go into some specifics and talk about what we can do to push back against them. You're listening to the Steve Cortez Show on AM 560, The Answer. Welcome back to the Steve Cortez Show. I am Charles Love, sitting in. Before the break, we were talking about what I like to call woke education. I like that term. That might be my next article. We were talking about the problems that we'll be facing when we go back to school. And we were talking with historian and New York Times bestselling author Larry Swikart. And go on. You were finishing your point on how bad the 1619 Project is and what we do about that.
Well, and it had to do with, by the mid-20th century, most of our teachers coming out were immersed in this idea of relativism that said that all ideas were equal. Therefore, there wasn't an exceptional America whose founding might have been better than anybody else's. God forbid we have that. Once you had that established, it was a short jump to start getting that America was worse than everybody else and that the culprit was slavery. And so once you had embedded the idea of relativism in American education, it was only a matter of time. And that's really what the 1619 Project plays on.
Yeah. So what do we do? How do we push back against that?
Well, I think it's essential for every parent, every educator, to begin to understand what an exceptional country America is, why we are different from everybody else, why slavery was everywhere in the world, so that makes it absolutely non-exceptional. It's one of the things that everybody had, so obviously it has nothing to do with American exceptionalism. And what's more important is that the United States went out of its way, even from the beginning. Yes, I know people are going, what are you saying, Swikart? Even from the beginning, to outlaw slavery. And I have no better evidence than the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, that banned slavery in all the new territory the U.S. had just gotten. If the U.S. was a slave country, that would have been opened up to slavery. But instead, they said, we are going to go out of our way to limit and try to get rid of slavery.
Definitely. You know, I'm a bit concerned, obviously, because of this approach we're talking about, but because of the people who I don't think really see how bad this is. I think this should be the hill that conservatives are willing to die on. Everybody's talking about we're in for our next civil war. You know, yeah. I think the war is in education, and very few people realize it yet. And by the time they do, it may be too late. You know, and what made me really see this was recently. I think I mentioned this to you earlier. So I had this Facebook post that I did because, you know, the NFL, in their infinite wisdom, was saying, hey, we're going to do our part to stop police brutality by playing a song. Silliness. But
yeah.
And it's not even that I agree with it. What's so fascinating about it. So I posted something about it because I saw so many people saying they had never even heard of the song. So my post was simply the fact that so many whites say they don't know that there was a quote unquote, in quotes, Black national anthem illustrates why we need more conversation. Now, obviously, people took from that, oh, why do you want to have two national anthems? And what's wrong with you? Are you a separatist? I'm like, did you read my Real Clear Politics article about the Declaration of Independence? I am far from that. I am pushing context, and this kind of leads to what you're talking about and how we solve the problem. So you talked about the relativism. So what I was saying there for the people who didn't get it was, I didn't want you to, I don't care whether you know the song or not. I think it's an issue that you don't know that the songs exist. And what I'm worried about is this indoctrination is going to be so hard. That kid's going to come home. Those teachers are not only teaching them, you know, skewed history, but they're skewing them against their parents. So you can't do what you used to do 15 years ago. You can't just say, well, they're wrong, I'm right, and think that's going to be okay. Or America's great, move on, because the kid's going to look at you and say, ha, my teacher said you'd say that, you're the problem. So they need to be armed with information. So my concern is they're not enough people out there, American regular citizens and parents, that know enough about history. It's not black history. I don't want black history taught in February. I want all of American history to be taught in context. So when you talk 1890 to 1920, blacks, Native Americans, everybody, the Chinese are all in there, because nobody knows about the average American doesn't know about the Chinese and the railroad and people's women selling themselves into, you know, have as sex slaves so they can make money. People don't realize. So I had someone today tell me that, well, don't you think you started off at a different level as blacks because of slavery? Yes. So don't you think that that's the reason why you can't get ahead today? And I said to that person, I get why you would think that, because the schools have failed you. But let me ask you this. Did you know that in Bronzeville, D.C., Philadelphia, all these other places, there was a thriving black America? And the wealth, blacks had amassed wealth and property to a surprising level coming from where they had come from. So my question isn't about, you know, about that. The question should be, how did it happen then and it didn't happen now? My concern is no one's teaching them that. So everybody's going to get a heavy dose of racism and slavery, which is fine, but they're not going to be any context. Close me out with 30 seconds here.
Well, yeah, Charles, I would just say that perhaps the discussion we need to have, it should we even have public schools at all, that after this, this disease kind of basically eliminates most of them from opening, who's going to step up and do the real job of educating children? Maybe it's time we look at private schools and start looking, not that many of them are a whole lot better, but that we start looking at private schools and we look at homeschooling and start taking seriously again the education of our children as our responsibility, not our teachers' responsibility.
Wow, that is like an education version of what the left is doing with criminal justice reform. You have those extreme people who say, don't fix it, don't reform it, blow it all up. You're basically saying the schools are lost.
I am saying that, yeah.
Wow, we definitely have a long way back. We're going to have to leave it at that and talk to you again. You have definitely given us some wonderful insight. That is Larry Schweikart, historian, author, New York Times bestselling author, and PragerU instructor as well. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Charles.
Now, when we come back, we will talk more about education and some of my views about how we fix this and what I am working on in that education space to make things better. You're listening to The Steve Cortez Show on AM 560, The Answer. So raise your glass if you are wrong. Back to the Steve Cortez Show. Charles Love sitting in for, wow, the last segment. Man, does this go by fast when you're having fun. So, I think I want to wrap a bow around this education thing and give you some insight on some places you can go and some things you can do, because this thing is going to be, and I truly want people to understand that a lot of things today are considered divisive and political. This is not one of them. Obviously, if you're on the fringes, maybe, but I don't know many people who consider themselves liberal who want what these people are calling for their child's education. And but they don't really know where to go or what to do. And some of them, unfortunately, don't even know what's happening. So that's where we come in. Like I said at the top of the hour, Charles Love. I am the Assistant Executive Director of Seeking Educational Excellence. That's seekingeducationalexcellence.org. And you should look us up. What we do, I mean, our mission statement is to eradicate social justice agenda in academia. So what does that mean? It doesn't mean that, you know, you have to have certain political leaning. This is a nonpartisan organization. What we're saying is, especially for poor kids and specifically black kids who are struggling academically, who are lagging behind others. What we need is structure. We need proper education, and we need the opportunities everyone else has. So we want you to focus on STEM as opposed to teaching what 1619 wants to teach you in school. Again, I'm always saying give the left their argument. If I give them the argument and say this country was built on the backs of slaves, it was built specifically for racism, and everybody, you know, prior to 1901 was a racist, I would then ask you, you got two kids in school today. You have a white kid in the suburbs. You have a black kid in the inner city. They're both going to school. They're both the same age. So let's call them 11. They're in sixth grade. They're learning what they need to learn. The kid in the affluent suburban school is starting to learn robotics and the right code. And the kid in the black school in the inner city, is learning about his ancestors being owned by others and about people who have these deep-seated, negative, stereotypical, and wrong views of him. In 5 years, who will be better prepared to perform? That's the only question that really matters. So what we say at C is take the social justice out. And particularly, I want to set aside to a lot of my friends, because as you get older, you work hard, you get to be a little bit more successful. Like Larry said, you're not immune if you're sending your kid to private school. One of the funniest, you know, I'm kind of straightforward. So one of the funniest things I had, situations I had, was taking my son to school and looking, listening to what they're telling them. And I'm looking, because in all these elite schools, you know, and all these private schools, the schools in certain neighborhoods, you got all these very young white progressive women teaching. Okay, that's who applies. What are you going to do? Probably really good at their job. But I look and I think, okay, I'm black. I'm married to a black woman. I got a black son. He's going to school. I'm thinking they're learning, teaching him math and science. And I got a 26-year-old white woman teaching him how to be a black man. No, you teach him how to build a robot. You teach him science. You teach him calculus. You teach him this. I will worry about that point. You know, so I think that it is really setting people up to fail when you do that. So that's one of the things we do. We also advocate for teachers because we believe that non-political, again, right? There are plenty middle-of-the-road, left-leaning, right-leaning college professors and teachers who don't sign on to this and don't know where to go, what to do. And us on the outside, not being in school, we don't see how bad what they're being fed and what they're being told to do from the administration is. So we need to see that. And I think that us trying to coalesce those people are good. We work with students. We help them. One of the arguments from the left is the black kid and the white kid, they can't get the black kid can't get a high score on the ACT, SAT because the white kids can afford to take prep classes. One, it's racist because you're assuming all black people can't afford anything. But what we do is we help with that college prep so those kids who need to get that those prep courses to get their scores up can do that. I'm reading here from the NEA, the Large Teachers Union site for justice, talking about things they're going to do in the fall. They want to teaching for black lives, they say, and rethinking schools. Black Lives Matter at school. They have a whole website dedicated to racial justice in education. Their 2020 curriculum resource that teachers can go to and get ideas on how to bring this stuff into school and so forth and so on. You don't know what these people are going to do to your kids. And like I said, people need to be armed with education and knowledge. And when those kids come home, they can deprogram them without just saying, you're wrong. America's great. And walking in the other room. You need to have facts when they tell you that this happened. You know, I talk to some of my younger, especially younger friends, black and white, and they don't know that blacks were not only graduating from college, but going to Ivy League schools in the 1920s. What changed? So we focus on that. We're more about empowerment at C than anything else. So look us up, seekingeducationalexcellence.org. It's been a pleasure. You know, call the station and flood them with calls and tell them to get me back on the air in Chicago. This has been wonderful. Thanks, Steve Cortez, for letting me sit in for you. This has been the Steve Cortez Show on AM 560, The Answer.